What the percentage of fashion? 70? I mean, you know, what's the fashion to music, you know? Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's cool. So, I mean, I think that, you know, what... I was, when I first heard him, and I thought it was really cool, and I said, yeah, you're kind of like Suicide in a good mood, you know? And he didn't like that at all. He wanted to be unique, you know, like everyone thinks everything that they do is like the only thing that's ever been done. And so then I didn't really hang out with him for years after that. I guess that was an insult to him or something. That's and weird. Then now we're like...
It's pretty high compliment, really.
Yeah. Well, you know, and so he, you know, I always like what they do because that seems to be the only purpose for that kind of music is to get a bunch of people together and slag around and have some fun. And the fact that it is so over the top pretentious is what makes it really interesting.
Yeah.
That the content is like 1% and the pretense and the in crowd, the high school in crowd vibe and all that is what really always interested me about it. That this little club of people were so militantly into what they did and there really wasn't a whole lot going on. So it wasn't about they were great artists or anything. They were just, it was like they were a gang.
Right.
It's funny because actually that aspect's funny. When they showed up, I mean, I remember when Quintron that showed up and started doing that stuff, and I kind of resented it. I just thought, like, what the hell is
this? I just totally dismissed it until just recently.
All of a sudden, we were there, like, working on gigs, and what the hell?
Well, I felt the same way about when I first saw when I first saw the Bingo Show. I was like, this is okay. This guy's like Tom Waits in the circus on crack or something.
Right,
it's like, and then I see all the people. It's like this is a lifestyle. This is like they're living or becoming a life.
Yeah. I remember. It's like when I lived in New York in the 70s, the most popular bands were not the bands that we hear about now. The most popular band was called Our Daughter's Wedding. And they were pretty much like the Molly Ringwalds of new, they did, you know, Joy Division covers and dressed up and did the whole,
yeah.
I mean, and you know, you think like that the hip world is actually hip, but it isn't. I remember there was in 1980, there was the judge, it's like 35 dance companies who were going to come in to try to get a season at the kitchen. And the bad joke was, out of the 35, 32 of them used either Phil Glass, Steve Reich, or Talking Heads as their background music. Uh-huh. So, you know, these are supposedly, this is the creative cutting edge, but really it's a pack.
Right.
It's a pack and it's a gang and a whatever, and it has no bearing on whether you come up with something. And then, really, the people that were doing interesting things in New York, for the most part, were shunned and shut out, which is like it is in a lot of places.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, fringe. I'd much rather hear Jeff Mattson play his, like, frickin' golf cart, you know, than 90% of the New Orleans music that I hear.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's sitting in his place, you know, it doesn't come
out.
A lot of
so many things in rock and roll business are festooned with guys from art school, whether it's even Old English scene that are sitting there going, well, you know, music's all right, but I'm going to use it to do this. They want some larger scene, and then you end up with some kind of, there really is some kind of sort of, there's odd sort of, because learning music, study of music is like a technical thing. It's not even, you hardly learn any presentation. You learn, like, you know, what to do with noises. Like, it's, you know, but whereas it's easier to run a takeover of that if you have any kind of presentation ability or a larger environment.
I see Ravi Skirvix as being like having some interest, you know, really heartfelt, really emotive music, but he puts the performance. It's the performance knob is turned up so loud that you cannot sometimes hear what he has to say. And I've worked with him before. I played in the Black Market Butchers recently, and I had to kind of, I mean, it was too much, and I just decided to not, you know, I'm not probably going to do that show too much more, but for various reasons. But I think that his ability to come up with this, like, theatrical material is very good. He's a stage, but when you hear him play solo, you also get that. All it takes is a piano. He'll just pound the shit out of the piano to create that screen of over, like, just a, like, it's like this mass shock performance that has to come before, right, between the audience and him.
Well, did you see Threepenny? I mean, he was really good in that.
Oh yeah.
And what I've had, yeah, I've had CDs of his home stuff in my car and with me for years, and I really like that. A lot of it, it's like the early, what he really does is early David Bowie,
right, because
he writes very tuneful songs, mm-hmm, and he sings them really well. And then he has refused to ever present them in a way that anyone can listen to them.
Exactly. That's exactly
so
how
that's
I feel.
Like, I would say he's like going to not connect at all costs, you know, and he, because he doesn't, it's like, I think maybe it's,
who knows why,
it's, who, I mean, knows, it's not cool to reveal your heart, whatever, you know,
I don't know what,
it's, he's just, but I love, see, I listen to his stuff all the time,
yeah,
because
I like him too,
once you get used, I mean, but he'll give me these things and they'll be like fifth generation, half analog, half digital, tape hiss, you gotta actually wade through the tape hiss. And
there's always that. No matter what it is, he could be playing a bottle, and he would overdrive it somehow.
It's a certain aesthetic in this neighbor. I mean, you know, and Lefty pushes that whole thing. It's like the really, you know, where it's funny because Quintron doesn't really do it. Quintron actually has a really good console, and he obviously knows electronics.
Yes.
And he makes recordings that are actually pretty good. But then some of the stuff, like the tracheotomy stuff, is there's some interesting, mm-hmm, sonic landscapes that come out of the whole scene. But to me, I just always thought, well, this is way more about the scene than it is about any music.
Sure.
And so that's fine. And those things come and go, you know.
Right.
After you just
you
watch
ride that
it,
wave.
You just watch it.
Yeah, you do. That's what it feels like.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, my first experience was with Ratty. He came on the radio with me one time, and he was just performing by himself playing piano. So I'd seen him with Rough Seven, so I wasn't sure what to expect. And he, you know, was really, really good. And then when I'm hearing him with Rough Seven, it's like his piano is like the emotional chord that really anchors all of Scully's lyrics.
Right.
I mean, it's when you hear something, you feel it. It's right. He's right on that.
Right.
He's the part where the emotional connect is there. So it shows that he has a diversity. He's figuring out where he's going to come up with next and what he's going to do. Where, you know, how he's going to finally present this next concept. So when I saw him, it's like I feel like here's this like raw talent, raw canvas, raw paint. Who knows what it's going to come up with next. He just seems like he's all over the map.
Well,
and like maybe he needs the stroke of a producer to figure out what cokes out of him. I don't know.
He's unproducible. He'd ruin it. So I mean, you know, what am I gonna? What I do? Clean him up for the world? What is that? How good is that? I tell you, I'm listening to him in my car already. What do I want it any different?
Right.
Just that visual.
Give him a bath and get him in some men's clothes.
That should explain the music business right there in one line.
Yeah.
No, you know, my job is to not clean people up, and that often that's, you know.
Yeah.
And now we've reached a point in time where that's a perfectly valid thing. Whereas even like 10 years ago, that was like, you know. Don't hire that guy. He ain't gonna clean him up.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I was talking to you about this a few minutes ago, and something that I wanted to just kind of bring up as a statement, because it seems like it's sort of a mission statement from you. This thing that Jimbo wrote, everywhere is now. Everywhere is a now. Mm-hmm. And it's because one of the reasons why I thought about this and asked you to do this interview is the whole idea of creating something new, being in the present tense. Dealing with 2011 on its own terms, and that's something that everyone in this room, you know, you guys are involved in that every day. So I just want to get your take on all that.
On the present,
why it's important to be creative and create something new. That's from yourself, from Jonathan, from Helen, whatever Mark. How you decide to put something, a creative stamp on what you do. How that's relevant to you.
You know what's going on there, like if I break down what your question is, as far as, and I don't know whether this is going to have interest to you, but really you're talking about a lot of elements of meaning there. So when we talk about now or the future of the present, you know, there's the mechanics of music. We have no way to understand music except using memory. So it's all, it has, it, although it's something that occurs presently, we only put it together with reference to how it sounds compared to something that happened beforehand. So there's a deception when we talk about, it's one of the things that shows that there's a deception that we play when we think that we're doing something modern or present or anything like that. The act of comparing it to something that occurred previously is actually a musical act. On the other hand, there's what we're talking about, which has to do with how we how we run our concept of history and all those things. And those things shift. So in other words, at some point in the early 20th century, 100 years ago, like you can talk to a young kid now, somebody who's 14, the concept of 100 years ago was a very long time ago. And at that point, 100 years ago, people were talking about being modern or contemporary already at that point. But for a kid, modern is clearly now archaic beyond belief. It's like being Victorian in 1960. It's like, it's ridiculous. So there's two different sides to the meaning of that, of everywhere is a now, because all of that, even our concept of history, occurs in the present, right, in a way. On the other hand, music demonstrates that we have no concept of music except by comparing the sound that we're hearing now with the sound that already occurred. So the two things are the situation in which you create that reality. Does that make sense?
Yes. Yes, to me it does.
I think there's a tendency to always postpone things. Like, I think a lot of people will gravitate towards, like, putting something for tomorrow, or I'm going to quit tomorrow, or I'll do that tomorrow. And it's nice to, I mean, I think what maybe isn't important about being, like, an improviser or improvising and just, you know, creating music with people and relating to them now, in the moment now, is an important thing that sort of transcends music into how you interact with people on a day-to-day level. Like, I mean, that's how I feel. You know, the more that I'm creating, you know, that's why I play the music I do, just because I think it makes me feel comfortable with how I relate to people on a day-to-day level. Just being present with them, or, you know, not thinking about how the repercussions are, you know, or what's going to happen in the future, but just seeing where somebody's at now. And I just like how that permutates into the rest of my life. The more I open myself up musically, the more it seems to mold me as a person or put me on the path that I feel like is a good one.
One of the things that I get from your music, seeing you know, you live, and that I really respond to, is that you seem to be connected to everything in the room, which is the music, the musicians, the way you orchestrate, the way you lead your bands in various places, and the way you connect with your audience. It's all part of this one thing. It's not something I see a whole lot of. It's something you seem very comfortable with that, and it's something the audience definitely responds to, because when you're in the audience, you feel like this person is not doing something indulgent. They're communicating. They're singing the song for a reason, for me, or revealing something in themselves that's for public consumption, but it's very personal. It's a difficult balancing act, and not too many performers get that and know what that's about. And to me, it's like the more you do it, the better you get at it. And so the performers that do this well, they have a different kind of relationship with their audience, and I feel like you definitely culture that. I'm not sure whether you do it consciously or not, but it's something that I noticed seeing you play.
Well, I mean, you know, I mean, I think that a lot of the people that have inspired me to improvise are musicians that come from like a classical background and have gone into jazz or have come from a, you know, classical background, gone into punk music. Or I've listened to a lot of cello players. Tom Cora comes to mind, and Abdul Wadud, although I don't know as much about his life, his, you know, just, you know, French horn players that have, whatever, just improvisers, you know, that have come from a place that has been more constricted or restrained musically and then broken out of that, have influenced me. And but also I think it's just part of being. Somebody asked me last night, you know, where does it come from? Where does your openness come from, or something like that? And I guess it's just I was very lucky being raised in three continents at like when I was 2 or 3, and so I think honestly it was just having to communicate with somebody who's Malay and Hindi and French and Swedish and American all in the same day when I was a little, so like maybe, but I mean, but as far as being you know, incorporating that into being a musician, it seems important to relate to everything around you in the present moment. It seems like you're playing for an audience, and even a lot of the music that I'm involved in can be very self-indulgent or very alienating to an audience. It can go down that route, but I feel like it's important to make sure you're you know, incorporating everything influences me in a room. So even if I'm trying to be self-indulgent and intellectual about what I'm doing, I'm still going to be influenced by people that are, they've paid some money to be there, or you know, or just are sitting there. And I mean, sometimes I do want to alienate certain people in the audience if they're like fucking with me or something, but you know, most of the time you want to you get influenced as a performer. I think I'm starting to talk in circles about it, but I don't know, it makes sense, but if that answers anything.
Yeah, absolutely.
So yeah,
been sitting on my mind since I knew we were coming in here, which is really to ask of Mark, which is this. Since you run a studio, and you were saying a minute ago that things had to do now with why would you bother producing something like that to make it smooth for somebody else, what is the difference, what's changed in the situation between, let's say, now you're going to make a record and you start thinking, in the old days, like what would be the difference between, you know, hiring Carole Kane or one of those kind of figures to do something,
mm-hmm.
and now the way that you think about it, what is this shift, and what the hell is the meaning of it, and has it a shift?
Well, it's not so much a shift from what I have to do, it's a shift in the, okay, suppose you got some music and you want to record it. Over the years, we've had record labels as Roman censors on the hill, right? And they would pick out what the masses were going to get to hear. And those places all had their own recording facilities, which were manned by exceptionally good people recording them. So everyone got the same treatment, whether it was the Emerson String Quartet or, you know, Big Bill Brunzi or whatever. So then we go back, the dam started to break, you know, in the 70s, and slowly there was an erosion away from the power of, you know, the distribution and marketing power of those big record labels. So you cut to the modern era, there's no place for, there's no destination really for anyone to seek out.
Mm-hmm.
There's only, you have music and you can present it as you see fit. There's no, the idea of a radio mix is now completely you know, it makes no sense whatsoever. And so all those bands that used to be trying for the brass ring of indie rock, it ain't there anymore. And what's there is this whole other system of cultivating your deal with your fans, and you build a fan base, and you don't go through, you do it directly, you don't do it through a corporate entity.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea of cleaning, now if a band, if a person comes in and they need musical help, as in conceiving, well, where am I going, what am I doing, and there are people that are really great that still think, wow, I could do this. And then, so then you try to get other people around them to make it work.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, and so a lot of the producing thing is more like casting as opposed to, and then there's the times where, you know, I'll just be doing all kind of stuff, you know.
So it's,
you know, my job now is completely, I never know what it's going to be.
So do you feel that there's a difference in filling out the process of filling out sessions now to fulfill a kind of music, and the hiring of a of a crew to do something than there was 30 years ago?
Well, in those days, it was about making instant, you know, when you'd hire, you know, Hal Blaine and Joe Osborne and Carol Kay, that whole crowd in Los Angeles, you expected, you did it because they could play this stuff real well, real fast, and they were very creative. You know, session people often get a bum rap from working musicians as if session people are just, you know, the robots. Reason that they get, they do the work is because they're so creative, not because like when you come in and play on Peter Stanfill and like go, oh, let's tune the bass down an octave and then hit that and the, you know, and you're the guitar player, you're not the bass player, and yet, so what it is a process where everyone's comfortable with everyone and everyone goes, what about this? And then the stuff that doesn't work gets filtered out, nobody has their feelings hurt, you just roll until you got something cool, and then that's it. I mean, that's your basic process, and that's how it has been. Of course, there's all the things where, the thing I never see anymore is the thing where, or rarely, is when there's an arranger that puts the whole thing, and 30-some musicians come in, and they all play it.
Yeah.
And that there's no more concentration.
Concentration.
The musicians are no longer able, in the Pro Tools era, to play a song without screwing it up.
You know, it's very
it's unbelievable.
It's clearly, it's a time-bound thing. It's funny, I was just poking again through Tommy Tedesco's Guitar Book, which is incredible, called For Guitar Players Only, of which half the book, right, Tommy Tedesco, this is that period, half the book is how you're supposed to act in a session, and what goes on in sessions, and what kind of music, and how to make them, even how to tune other guitar, string instruments so that you can tune them like guitar so you can get the extra money because it would be 50% of
everything. Oh, yeah. It's all listed in there. All that shit's gone. That's
over. You barely get a guitar player or singer-songwriter that knows how to tune guitar.
Yeah, you're trying to psych out the producer to get triples out of the thing.
Now, the fascinating thing, the thing in reference to what you're saying is the main thing that he's saying in there over and over again is when these sessions go on, concentrate. Concentrate, concentrate, concentration. Right. Concentration, concentration. This is all he's talking about. Well, and so now that's completely...
You know, the thing is...
It's all distraction now.
Everything is designed for distraction nowadays.
But for if this is all about... We go back to what Mike was asking about creativity. And, you know, I don't even know what that is. I just know what I do every day, but I don't even know what it is. So for me to intellectualize creativity... I just can't even do it. I just feel like a monkey then. It's like, what does it mean? Because everything's been done, and what am I recycling other people's ideas endlessly and calling myself creative? I mean, what am I doing here? But it's people. You know, you play yet write. I don't know anyone else that, you know, does what you do. I don't know anyone else that does what Helen does. Mm. So that's what's interesting.
Right.
I mean, there's cello players out there that can, like, rip it, you know? Mm-hmm. And, I remember, what's the dude's name? Starker when I was a kid?
No.
That fuck.
Yeah. He's got the method books. I've studied those method books.
You know, you think, okay, but not everyone set out to be, you know, they churn out 3,000 cello players every year out of all those music factories. And where do they go? You know? What do they do after
their shop jobs while they're looking for orchestral work?
Yeah, well, I guess. And then where's the orchestral work? Because we don't have. Everyone was always talking in New Orleans. Oh, we're going to build a sound stage, and the sound stage and the movies will save us. Well, I mean, I did all this stuff on the Green Lantern movie, and I mean, it was a bunch of, you know, R&B stuff. And then there's a composer, and the composer has 8 people working for them doing orchestrations and writing this and fitting the cues and. And then, when it's all said and done, the director and they finally get it, they do one day, maybe two at the most, if it's a big budget, on a soundstage in Vancouver or Hungary or Bulgaria, where where you get $10 an hour musicians, fly your hard drive to Bulgaria, rock on.
Yeah.
So the interesting thing, the economics now of being a classical musician, where at one point, if you were like one of the best players in New York, you had all this work, and now you're like, and you know, so it's tough, and the same, the economics of, because of the gas prices, the economics of touring, because it's, the whole thing is, you have to approach everything differently when you think about what you're doing now, because nothing is like it was in terms of presenting music, and so here we are in our bubble here, which is unlike anywhere else in the world, where we have tons of live music and we all run around. And even if I wanted to go out and gig instead of sitting in here all the time, you know, there's plenty of opportunity. Whereas most places, I mean, New York, you got to like beat the streets forever.
Yeah.
You know, and try to get, and then there's nothing. And you know, so it's.
It is more about the
now. It's tough, but, you know, the intellectualizing of stuff, I mean, you know, with the scariest word in the world, you know, is inappropriate. And that's what's killed all the academia. I mean, is to, you know, I was like, sometimes I think, no wonder Castro wasted all this. It's not that bad, but, you know.
Well, one of the things, one of the reasons why we brought that up is because, you know, Jonathan and I were at a bar one night, and we're talking about this, and we're talking about the whole retro scene, and how these kids are like, they not only just playing this, but they're playing obscure stuff from the 20s and 30s, and I'm like, where is the reference point for this? They're not even playing the trad catalog, but it's this whole scene of dancing, the fashion, and everything else.
Theater,
but
obscure again,
to
again.
Who? Not
theater.
Obscure to me.
Yeah.
Because I've been around that stuff. There's always been a scene like that. In Indiana in the late 60s and early 70s, there was a band, Happy Feet. They did the whole thing. They were the only band in Bloomington that did that, and they did it really well. And they had, and then all those guys like Randy Sankey, who's the trumpet player, and he kind of, all that stuff on Stash Records. Believe me, this stuff is just ever modern. It's just this new generation just landed.
Squirrel Zippers or South Street Spikers.
Yeah, but Squirrel Nut Zippers really didn't do it. They did their own thing, and it wasn't an attempt to be doctrinaire. They had their own crazy thing that they did, and they were individuals, which is what made their success.
On the other hand, I think a lot of what we're looking at out there with these guys is actually a lot of more people that would have seen Squirrel Nut Zippers when that showed up, and this is where, you know, they ended up with a more... It's somehow they looked at that and were like, it got, you know, even more. They got religious about it.
Right.
Where Jim O'Connor doesn't have to be religious about it.
Yeah, he's like, another band he was in.
Well, the question I always had to ask is, where does it end? I mean, okay, so it's the music, it's the fashion. So do they walk around with monocles and do they eat certain dishes?
Fashion.
I mean, the whole.
I don't know.
It can go far. It can go really far in someone's psyche and how they live their life.
Well, what about you know, you're going to play a gig in the bill with fish. What about like the million fish fans?
Well, we could.
They dress like fish. They smell like fish doesn't smell bad. But you know, there's that whole you know, it's like, imagine the music scenes have their own aromatherapy. You know,
that's they do. They, mm-hmm. they do. Yeah.
So each scene is judged by the pheromones.
Sniff jazz. You know?
Sniff jazz.
Sniff jazz.
I like that.
I'm starting sniff jazz. I just want to put it on the record.
Sniff jazz.
I had my first sniff jazz gig, and there was nobody there in the middle of Jazz Fest.
I like that. They're playing like that. I see those guitar players that actually play all these changes, and that's cool. But then when they solo, it's like they're doing the same solo. And if you go listen to Charlie Christian or something, he didn't do that solo. And you listen to Django Reinhardt, he didn't do that solo. You listen to Barney Kessel, Telfar, they weren't doing that. But see, these are more
new
like
solo.
And not to diss, but it's more like, it's like a Steve Mazurkowski solo, which is perfect every time. Mm. And so the perfect every time thing, I'm like, I never got it.
That's like classical music.
A lot of jazz, they're responding to the fact that I think a lot of the jazz that, you know, you heard Monk and Mingus and Archie Shepp and Rassan and that stuff of my time, I didn't want to be them. I wanted to worship them. you know? I knew I was not them. I could play my guitar and sing and people would give me money and like it, but I was definitely not Rassan, Roland Kirk material. Mm-hmm. And so I think now with this other music, it's like it's pretty safe playing this retro stuff, because the modern jazz thing, you know, you get hit with the whole, again, the what is real jazz is 50, 49 to to feed to Kilimanjaro. When she had the Kilimanjaro, that was the end when the electric piano and when they started drumming loud and the electric piano came in. That's the end. So if you do like the Lincoln Center thing as term repertoire thing, there's a lot of that. But then again, the Lincoln Center, you know, Whit Marcellus is putting out records with Willie Nelson. So what does that mean? You know, so really there's not such a doctrinaire thing. With that stuff, it's marketing. Press Hall thing is like whoever's doing that is brilliant because there ain't no music there.
Right.
I mean, I heard that. I mean, all these collection records they put out. I mean, and somehow they've convinced all these rock star and bluegrass stars to do this stuff, and as if this is when Preservation Hall is street cred around the world, you know we're in trouble.
But, you know, that same template can be applied to also the funk bands, even the brass bands, where it's like, you know, it's the same thing that you've heard over and over again, which to me, it's like, I don't understand, why would I want to listen to somebody else doing I Just Kissed My Baby?
That's what they do, and they don't, I mean, it's a limited world unless the technique gets better and the worldview gets better. It's just like, it's like gangs again. That's like, the thing, that's what I like about, like, Big Ship. I like that band because it's a neighborhood gang. And the people aren't exactly great players, and a lot of the stuff's out of tune. But it's really cool, and it's like people playing with their friends. It's like the Sex Pistols.
Why are we building
this? And a lot of these bands are like the brass band thing. But again, if the brass band thing came in and they started playing, and any of these creative brass bands rocked the world, the reality is they're not. And is this such a bad thing?
I think there's three elements here. There's three things we're talking about here. One is the connotation of the past and using the connotation of the past as a triggering point for audiences to put them in a space, which is no different than, you know, in Mozart's opera, in the abduction from the Seraglio, he's using a lot of Turkish symbols in there. It's not Turkish music, it's Viennese music. Right. But the fact of the matter is that the symbol had a connotation to people of Turkey, and that was very popular at the time, and he could run a whole thing with people's fantasies about exoticism from it. But it's there on purpose in order to do that. After that, he can run all the panoply of Viennese tricks that only he could do. So the thing about that is something like, why are we building Big Ship? Again, this is Waltz playing games with, these are connotations of the past, and he's shifting them around. They're moving. But it's not the action, he's not trying to deliver you what they used to do, which is vastly different than when you see some of the trad bands doing. What they're doing is an absolute recreation. It's not a connotation. Right. It's not having a flavor of that. It's
taking it, making his own. I mean, he really does make it his own.
So then the thing about that, the thing about that that I find interesting is this: is okay. So in the one hand, you have a technical trigger, a composed trigger that's there to do something to the mind. It's to invite people in order that you can carry on a dialogue about something else, right? So you have something that's beneath, you have some consciousness of surfacing back. Now, there's another feature here, which is when you're talking about the great, these big, really good brass bands in New Orleans, like, it's a Rebirth, the Hot Eight, that kind of thing, where you're talking about the hottest brass bands in New Orleans. I can tell you for sure, I had the Hot Eight come through the neighborhood the other day. We have a lot of brass bands come through the neighborhood. I could tell from four blocks away that I was hearing something unbelievable coming in my direction.
They rock the
house. I hear a lot, like, they rock the neighborhood, and I could tell from blocks away, I'm like, that's not ordinary music coming down my street. Whereas I've had other brass bands come down my street, I don't get up out of my chair, I carry on. And you could tell, that's power. And that power doesn't have to do with, it's always current. In other words, like when they're coming through, it's always current because they have to deliver because they're dealing with the heaviest life cycle events that are going on, and then that's an ecstatic music that comes under a different category. It's not intellectual, it's not appealing. It doesn't come from the appeal of thinking about something. It comes from the appeal of the necessity to do something to people. So under that guise, they're using the features of human life, literally life force, to deliver something. It can never fail to be present. It doesn't matter what happens on the outside. And so you're dealing with these three mixtures. So in other words, it looks like past and it looks like tradition, but that's always the most modern thing going. Those brass bands do that because they have to deal with the immediacies mm-hmm. of, of the different ages of people that are dying, that are living, that everything, and that's another thing. It's immediate. It doesn't have to do with recordings. It doesn't have to do with anything like that.
It's the most now, yeah.
So then, you know, and that's really the way that, I mean, you know, in my opinion, that's the way to look at that. And, you know, you have to see some kind of differentiation. Now, some people are going to want the appeal, you know, like if you see something like the Morning 40 Federation. This was a band, you know, and it's interesting because this, a lot of things when you're talking Big Ship or you're talking about Ratty or something like that. In the 40s were around, they were markers recording for a long time. And Scobie talking about, you know, Scully, you know, who was in that band. Very interesting band because, again, this is similar to Walton as much as its connotations of things that were from the past. But then again, you can see that they have a high mark going on the mix of ecstatic music.
Right.
So, and then, you know, and so you're looking at these two kinds of things, and then, and those divine, those kinds of forces are what are defining what Mark's talking about, which, whether you're going to clean it up, whether you're not going to clean it up, what you're going to do, how much of this kind of energy you're going to mitigate at any time.
Question I would have for you that we can throw it is, how much of this ecstatic music that we all love and that we know, and that's, say, the principal thing of what they call New Orleans music, mm-hmm. is that, which nobody ever talks about, but that's, yeah. you know, inside. How much of that ever gets on record? You know, I right. mean, I made one Rebirth record that I thought almost got close, that We Come to Party, and that has this, mm-hmm. but most of the Brass Band stuff, that it was like with Glenn Branca, that stuff that you hear when you're playing isn't there when it's on a record. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter who records it. You can't get a room. Microphones don't hear like brains. They don't hear the subtone. They don't hear the octave under when it gets real loud. They don't hear the octave. They don't hear it. Microphones are not brains. And it's interesting how we can perceive these things and then never again hear them. Impossible to recreate on a recording.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems to be like a lot of those things what you're talking about is almost like a manic energy, like a Hazel Atkins or a Little Richard or an Escarita, where you have this driving force of just exuberance, and those people, that's all they could do.
But
you know, yeah. there is nothing in between. So it's either all that or nothing for them. So, well,
except that I'm talking more like, you know, there's all over the earth, you know, the Southern Indian music that where this, you know, lasts for 7 hours, and the whole purpose of it is to reach an ecstatic state,
right?
And the whole purpose of the second line thing is to reach an ecstatic state. Mm-hmm. It's a different ecstatic state because you're, you know.
Well, you have
the Moroccan thing too is the same. That whole and all over, you know, you can go almost anywhere and discover this. And
well, you have first-hand experience of that with doing the Mardi Gras Indian music and Dirty Dozen, where you're trying to, you know, you and I both came on the scene at the same time and started seeing these bands. You knew this energy is there. It's like, how can this be put on a record? Can you capture it? It's really hard to capture the excitement of what you saw live.
The one thing that the Golden Eagles record from 1986 or whatever, that still sounds amazing, and it was very just nice. Very, you know, primitive. I mean, I was in the back of a van. I didn't even, you know, I couldn't stand up, and I could barely sit up back there.
Probably because you were there, you know. Yeah. I mean, this is how it kept.
And it was straight to two-track. But see, again, that was like my lack of technical thing. And I thought, like, we had all these, WWOZ had all these RE20 microphones. And RE20s are well known for, they don't sound bad coming in on the sides. And yet they get very much what's right in front of them. I was like, I'll use all of those. I'll use those on the vocals. And it looks pretty funny up there. People are, you're not using, seeing live stuff with those big-ass microphones up there. And it was like, and then so I did it, I just made an educated guess, mm-hmm. and then I ran it, and they just had this little crummy console, and I wouldn't even know what micro preamps they were, none of the stuff that I'd think about today if I was taking a job. And it was to a really horrible early digital format, mm-hmm. and yet the whole music, it's there, it is, and it sounds great. So, you know, who knows.
But people have been trying to capture that the power and the essence behind the live music with a more spiritual purpose or a very community-oriented goal for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. I mean, you know, from classical music, you know, the earliest recorders, like you know, the Bartok Kodai team in Eastern Europe on wax cylinders and the Moses Ash and Smithsonian collections. Mm. I mean, people have been trying to seek out that power that music has in the community and the real, you know, essence of it for a long time. And it's been it's always, I mean, even back in like, you know, the 1500s with like more, you know, religious versus secular music. I mean, there's a bastardization that happens when you take it out of that, or there, you know, there's, and you lose something, you know, maybe arguably, like when you take it out of that realm.
The context of community, where Zydeco, when Zydeco moved out of the country and into the city and became art.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's
very different.
Well, you know, from living in New York, how this is, how music gets presented there. Seeing like a Beausoleil in a sit down concert setting is just absurd. Or seeing, I saw the Dirty Dozen one time when it was at what's the place called? New York, I forget the name of it, but it was, you know, white linen tablecloths. And the it was $25 a seat and a $20.
Joe's
Pub? No. That wasn't Joe's. It was.
I've never been in Joe's Pub. It's the one, like. Out of the
A local guy owns it. Like, it was Spark. Cause it wasn't Sparks. So it was like one word like that. What Champs. Champs, I think.
Tramps.
Tramps.
Oh, Tramps.
Yeah.
Oh,
so okay, I saw him there.
Tramps, okay.
And
white linen table.
Yeah, and the, of course, people sitting at those expensive tables are all irritated when the New Orleanians got up to dance. It's like, sit down, you're in our way.
Right.
It's like, knock your table over and you should dance, you know?
Right.
It's just one of those things. I mean, like you say, you're right, because the context of how it's seen is so important.
But, yeah, see, some of the great music I've heard in New York has been in places like, you know, the Balkan Community Center.
Right.
Where 98% of the people there knew each other, and then there were five of us that came there to hear the hot, you know, gypsy fiddler or the hot mountain clarinet guy from, you know.
But, you know, this has to do with, like, there's another thing here, too, which is, like, you know, a musician, or a lot of musicians, not all musicians, but there's a certain amount of the sensitivity of you know, like, you're talking about what the presence, you're sort of everywhere is now. So when I go out and I see things, like, if I see a preponderance of people playing traditional, trying to imitate traditional music, I mean, first thing is, this canceled the Tom Paines write out. At the point where everyone was doing that, Alex and I really lost interest. Because my purpose in starting that, when we started doing that years ago, was people are writing really bad songs that are only about what the hell they feel. And no one, these songs were like reporting. It was kind of interesting. I was like, well, let's go out and redo these songs, do these songs only so people can see that people used to talk about something when they wrote a song, not just like, you know, not in a bunch of sort of platitudinous garbage that was coming, that was pretty much floating around what people were singing about. However, the context shifts and it shifts very quickly. Within 3 or 4 years, I'm out there and I watch everybody is out there doing tribe music, which means it no longer has any, in that context, it no longer has any meaning. There's too much of it. It's in imbalance, you know, and I want to be the first guy out of there. You know, fuck this. So it's a matter of, like, you know, like, get me off the ship. It's sinking. There's too much weight in the back, you know, whatever.
And, you know, I went and did that thing with Shannon McNally, which was a complete mutation of the whole thing, is where I took a ton of stuff out of those things and re-shifted all the lines, and so it became, so that's, you know, and that's archaic now, because that's the essence of postmodern, which is now as dead as, no, never mind.
On the other extreme of that is, it takes something that's so over the top and so ancient, which is like the Valparaiso, which is like, okay, you can take, if you're really going to go there, just go with something completely insane. And so,
you know, I'll tell you the truth, the Valparaiso thing, there's nothing archaic about that, because let's face it, Carlo is back there basically doing practically, you know, Carlo is, you know, if he was playing, I would understand. But he's back there playing the most syncopated garbage. I mean, it's not garbage. He's playing the most beautiful syncopated drums, because, and he's one of the only people in the world that can play like that. And he's back there the whole time, we're singing, apparently screaming sea shanties. He's doing that. There's nothing traditional about what goes on in the Valparaiso band, because both rhythmically, next thing is, you have Rick Trollson, right? He's playing trombone. And then all of us are screaming, and Alex can't get us to say the words in the correct brogue from the 19th century. Because, you know, you want to try to get Jay Holland. Yeah, bro. You know, it's all, forget it, man. It's nothing traditional about that band. It's, you know, I mean, just, again, that's a connotation thing. It has the connotation
right.
of being very old. But it's not, you know. Like,
what's cool is a lot of people in the audience would think it is traditional. And but you know. But they're gonna, and it's cool because then you're presenting it in a way that they're gonna think that that's traditional, but they're gonna hear it with a funkier drummer or like a trombone player that's playing these crazy solos, or Matt Rohde tearing it up, and just in a different way. Like they're hearing this traditional thing that's sea shanties, and they're getting maybe thinking that that's a normal sort of sea shanty experience. Do you think?
It makes it off the stage. That's what I was saying about things. Some things don't make it off the stage.
Yeah.
And other things do. And 90% of all this improvised stuff that we deal with, it don't make it off the stage. That is somewhere in between in the air out there.
Right.
And the ghosts don't like it, and they don't deliver it back to the people in the crowd for you.
Yeah.
And where Valparaiso certainly makes it off the stage and slaps everyone in the face with it, and that's interesting. Is I even like you'll go to DBA and hear stuff, and even sometimes like Walter Washington, as great as he is, it's like it ain't making it off the stage.
Yeah.
It's all a little inner language for the people up there, and it's not coming out. And that has nothing to do with selling out, being commercial, or cleaning up. It's just some weird connect thing. And They'll have a scientific basis for this in 50 years, but right now we can only speculate.
Well, the French already have a program that analyzes it and spit out parameters.
It's funny you bring up French. I was just thinking, I started singing in French just to do that exact thing, to be able to relate to an audience with, like, I wanted to improvise, because then you improvise, but I need to make a living.
Yeah.
So I was like, well, the people like French songs, and I'll get to practice my French.
Well, you know, it's funny you mentioned Walter Wolfman, because, you know, back in the 80s, I used to see him, and it was funny how I would see him based on where he was playing.
Mm-hmm.
And it was amazing. Like, the Walter Wolfman that would play at Tipitina's would wear a white suit, play a whole different set than the Walter Wolfman that played at Benny's. And the Walter would play at Dorothy's, right? Or play it. And each gig had its own different, completely different flavor.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's just, you know.
Well, that's how the brass band stuff is, too. It depends on which hood you hear people in.
Yeah.
And you know, that's always just like the comfort zone of the musicians and the audience.
Mm-hmm.
It's a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
And that some people, the people that can really do it and get it off the stage, are people that can go out and take anybody and just have them have communal experience with people you don't even know. And that's when you're at the juncture of going into showbiz or staying, you know, staying where you are.
Mm-hmm.
And then some people, you know, make bad decisions there. And, you know, it's like being a good prostitute, you know, if they move in the wrong direction, you know. Then again, eventually you're going to get old.
Mm-hmm.
And then that world's going to leave you, and, you know, so.
Anything you want to come on to, Mark?
Well, the only thing I was just want to think about the future of this, of how you guys see as where this is heading next, where your new music's heading next. I see you're heading back to school. Helen's on the scene here. You're going to stay here. So I just, you know, these different ideas of how you see, how you project things onto the next few years in New Orleans. I mean, obviously, the scene changes. Some things you can do nothing about, some things you can't. So my question is, how do you feel about the music that you guys have put forth so far, and where do you think it's going? Or where do you think the whole scene in general is going?
I don't know where anything's going. I don't. It's too much. And it's very funny, because yesterday I watched an interview with Paul McCartney in 1980, and they were asking him this question. He's like, I'm sick of hearing this question, because I don't know. If a guy like that doesn't know at that point in history, how the hell am I supposed to know? I don't know. Yeah, character there.
After which he said, turn off the mic, and he poked the guy and said, you got any weed?
Yeah, probably. But it was very funny because the guy was like, you know, it's like there's going to be a generation that doesn't know about the Beatles, and McCartney was like, it's already there, and you have no idea. There's people come to me and think I'm the guy, I'm the Mull of Kintyre guy. You know how long this is already. It's the interviewers are really, you know, stuff in there. So I don't know. What do you think?
New Orleans. Well, I mean, I can never, I can't predict, and I can't even consider what's going to, I mean, the dozen or so factions of music interests that happen in New Orleans are going to keep doing what they're doing. New Orleans, in general, being the, you know, the new mayor, the Jazz Fest, the tourist thing, they're going to continue to promote New Orleans so people will come and seek out the Noble Savage.
Yeah.
Well, the flip side of that question, is to ask all three of you, really, well, if you don't know where the future is, but why did you come here to begin with, and what kept you here?
That's a good question.
So maybe it's an easier question.
I got here first. I was sick of New York, and I thought it'd be more fun here, and I was right.
Yeah, that's why I moved back too.
Yeah.
I'm trying to come up with a new way to say this story. I was looking for a place to get. I've been in small towns in California playing music with the guys on the street and the alcoholics and. Anyway, I was looking for some place to where the music was a little bit more happening, a little bit more whatever, and I went to a lot of cities, and it was very fake there, like, you know, with Chicago, the marketing of it, but New Orleans kind of lived up to its mythology and its legend, both socially and in music, although New Orleans, of course, was a surface version of stuff, but at that time, it didn't, so it was remarkably penetrating for the young man that I was then, you know, so I stayed.
I was looking for a place that, besides, it was either Montreal or New Orleans, because I wanted some bilingual vibe, since I am bilingual, and I needed something with a French influence, and a jungle influence, being raised in the jungle, like Singapore. But ultimately, I think, what really drew me and why I've stayed, is I was looking for a place that wasn't, it's like a place that had some courage to look at, like, pain, and to not be put in an insane asylum because you're mentioning the word pain, and be able to, you know, open its doors to a cello player and a female musician. And I felt like this place wasn't crazy enough to at least let it go by, at least let it happen, without, you know, being given a cold shoulder or a closed door. You know, maybe people didn't even know better. You'll I'll sound like a guitar or bass player. It's fine. Cello, whatever. Big guitar. Or big violin, small bass. It's fine. And yeah, I'm a woman. It's cool. You like women here, right? It's fine. Let me on stage. It's cool. Like at least here there was, you know, there wasn't anybody I could really look up to that was doing it, but I at least felt like it was a welcoming community that for whatever reason I ended up on the stage. And it allowed me to do what I wanted to do, so that's why I'm still here.
Perfect.
Okay, good. I think we got everything we wanted to talk about.
Good.
Good.